ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Online, it feels like the answer is always yes. Yes to cookies, yes to tracking, yes to data sharing. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I find out what happens when you finally say no. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show, ABC Radio National. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to Late Night Live on ABC Radio National Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. All around the coast of this continent are beach shacks built out of driftwood and old iron by fishermen, surfers, hippies. Some have survived nearly a century. The lure of the beach shack, later with Anna Clark. But first, in 1975, two women in their 30s got together in Melbourne and started a publishing house. One was a rich kid with a job in advertising and the other a superb editor. It was a revolutionary moment. Two Australian women taking on the British boys who in those days ruled Australian publishing. Hilary McPhee and Di Gribble were good. Very, very good. And their house was a roaring success. The writers McPhee-Gribble signed in the 70s and 80s reshaped the literary life of this country. Then, and still now. Penguin swallowed McPhee-Gribble in 1989, but the splendour of that independent publishing house founded 50 years ago has never faded. To look back to that time, Hilary McPhee joins us from Melbourne. Hilary, g'day.
Hello, David. What a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Oh, I've got the editor's tick. Thank you.
You have.
How was it that in the middle of the 1970s, that you and Di Gribble came up with the idea that you'd do it yourselves, that you'd be publishers?
We really just wanted to work together. We'd done a little magazine for one of the women's movement things, and we loved doing that. And we just didn't really care what we did as long as we could work together. This was feminism, you know. It was more a matter of finding a good idea to work with. I'd been working in publishing, and Di had been in advertising, as you said. So somehow, packaging began. I don't know whether you remember packaging. It's when people did big illustrated books and farmed out the design and editing to packages. It was Rainbird came up with the idea in England, I think, and there were books that you could charge a fair amount of money for. So I just spoke to a couple of publishers and they agreed to give us things to package. And as a result of that, we went out and borrowed some money from Di's father. He gave us $3,000, which
was a lot of money.
But we signed a partnership agreement. That was what was peculiar to us. We wanted to be true and honest to each other at all times. It was not a corporate agreement. It was a partnership agreement. So we were very idealistic, and with our $3,000, we went out and bought a white Olivetti golf ball typewriter. They were the latest things. And golf ball typewriters let you change fonts.
And you just slipped the little ball out, and in went Calibri Bold.
Absolutely. We were very into typography, and it was a divine thing to have, to be able to change type and design things. And we could do a lot in that on that typewriter. We had two white chairs, a bottle of whiskey, and a white typewriter. That's all we had. And we started packaging books, and it went from there. We got an incredible amount of publicity just by starting, because women hadn't done this before.
You were seen at the time as invaders? Were you? Was it heroic?
No. People took a rather glamorous view of us because we had this white office, and two women working together, and with you know, we were idealistic, we were feminist, it was 1975, you know, it was a great time to start. Optimism was in the air hugely, and we were totally optimistic. And then came up with a fantastic idea of books for children, which was not being packaged at all. It was, I suppose we were packaging them for Penguin. Puffin in England had only ever taken about three Australian novels for children, Ivan Southall and people like that. They rather looked down on Australian stuff. But we came up with this idea for practical books for kids. Look, they'd go so well now. Kids who wanted to do things for themselves without parental permission. So we made sure they were safe and imaginative and things that kids would choose to do without having to ask their parents' permission. I mean, they probably did ask their parents. Their parents probably bought the books. But we made Penguin only charge $1 a copy. We were so idealistic, we thought the kids would buy them with their pocket money. It was that sort of era. There were no reprimands. There were no be careful, do this, ask your parents if you can. Words like scary and fun and exciting were forbidden.
Now, Hilary, what's wrong with scary, fun and exciting?
Because it's adults telling kids that things are scary. We wanted kids to find things out for themselves. That was the point. That we wanted them to do things for themselves, like change tires on bicycles. We did that in the office. We tested everything. We had kids in the office during school holidays trying everything out. And then we went around some of the local schools and tried things out on kids so we could see how they reacted to the illustrations that we'd commissioned from a terrific advertising illustrator called David Lancashire, who got very involved. In the end, we did about 21 of these little books. And they went on selling worldwide. Puffin did the sold rights, of course, into Europe. They nearly got into Africa, we heard, but they were certainly right through Europe. And we got about $3 million for those books in the end.
Kept you afloat.
Which kept us very much afloat. We got so little money for everything else we did. I still get PLR for them. It's what for.
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
and for Practical Puffins.
Yes, for a couple of titles that are still alive and kicking. So I would so love somebody out there to say, let's do another version.
But then one day, a young woman bicycled up to the office with a couple of copies of a manuscript that she'd been working on. Which kind of changed things? Who was the young woman?
This was Glenn Tomasetti, who was a folk singer, and she'd written a novel called Thoroughly Decent People about the 1930s. She was a historian as well. It was a very well-researched novel and a terrific novel. And we said, Glenn, we're not doing fiction. We're only doing these children's books. Go away. But she'd heard me launch Kate Jennings' collection of feminist poetry called Mother, I'm Rooted, which was a fantastic collection. And Glenn thought she wanted us to publish her. And she said, as people did in those days, I'll ride my bike round the block three times and then I'll come back and you'll tell me what you've decided. So Di and I flicked through this manuscript and looked at each other and said, let's do it.
So that was novel number one.
That was novel number one.
So you had a few novels under your belt before another young woman.
With a bicycle.
With
again.
A bicycle. Again with a bicycle. It seems to be a common theme of your work, bicycle tires, authors on bicycles.
In those days you had to give publishers two copies of the manuscript. And so they sat in people's bike baskets and the women trundled round to us. We were in a bunker by this stage. It was the beginning of our second year when Helen Garner showed up with Monkey Grip. And she said, I think I might have written a novel. Will you read it and tell me if I have? And we, of course, went home that night, both of us with a copy each, and came in the next day and said, we've got to do this. We've got to do this. It's
but now,
about
Hilary,
a world we knew about.
Really. Hilary, this is a chance for us to just speak quietly amongst ourselves on this point. How much editing did Helen's work require?
It required a bit, David, because it was based very much on her journals. It was obviously based on her journals, but it didn't. We didn't restructure it. We let it be what it was, and fiddled a bit and discussed. We only edited in those days in pencil because we thought the author should be allowed to rub it out. And Helen came in the next week and we sat her down and said what we thought was probably me sitting her down because I was the one more doing the editing at that point and saying that we really want to do it, but you do need to make a few changes. I think probably later, years later, we would have recommended a lot more changes. I think Monkey Grip's patchy, but it's lasted. It's still in print, David. It's amazing.
Oh, yes.
It's wonderful.
But was it really fiction? I mean, I've interviewed Helen recently for her new book, The Season.
Yeah.
And I put it to her that she's really Australia's best reporter.
Absolutely. I know, that's right. There's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, no.
And we knew it was based on actual people and a diary that recorded all of this stuff. And the funny thing years later when it was being made into a film was that a whole lot of people who were outraged that they're in Helen's novel trekked to Sydney and offered themselves to be in the film. So, you know, Jarvo turned up and...
It's still a wonderful book. Now, how many did it sell?
I think it sold half, something like 4,000 in hardback. We only did it in hardback initially, which is the kind of natural order of things in those days. We did a lovely hardback with a pink band on the back and a photo of Helen on her bike.
I can see it in my mind's eye now, a photo from above.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Ponch Hawks took the photograph. It was fabulous. Helen in a flowery dress riding a bike. And then we did a paperback and we kept on printing it because it kept on selling.
Wonderful, wonderful idea. Just keep on selling. On Late Night Live, my guest is Hilary McPhee, one of the two pioneering women publishers, Di Gribble being the other, who began the publishing house McPhee Gribble 50 years ago. So I take it, Hilary, that once the great success of Monkey Grip had established you as a fiction publisher,
yep.
Monkey Grip and Thoroughly Decent People, but then I would imagine you would have been inundated with manuscripts.
We were. They arrived at the Fitzroy Post Office. By then we'd moved. No, they arrived at the Carlton Post Office. We'd moved to Carlton by that stage. We actually started the next stage, David, I just have to add this, was I discovered I was having my third baby and Di was rung up by the adoption people and told that the baby that she and her husband had wanted to adopt was coming up in a month or something. So suddenly we had babies and everyone said, you have to go home, you've blown it. But we didn't. We found an old terrace in Carlton that was three-storey and had lots of spare rooms. It was very decrepit with a fire escape out the window and all that stuff. And we painted it, painted bits and pieces of it, and rented rooms to other small publishers and had the children downstairs in a nursery with a childminder. And suddenly we had staff having babies that they didn't think they were going to have. And we ended up, I think, with five or six babies in the McPhee-Wall childcare department.
It was a house of legend. It's a house of legend. Now, you did employ some men. Now,
oh yes,
what of kind course. Of men did you employ?
Only men that made us laugh and were a very original. You know, we didn't employ solemn men. We were doing all kinds of funny research by this stage, also practical puffins, and good ideas were needed for all kinds of books like one called Strange Things. Body Tricks was another big one, which was about things that you did with your body. You'd remember these things
I remember that book.
You remember that book? And it had a finger in a matchbox, you know, the cut-off finger with blood all around the cut-off finger and some gruesome things. But there were tricks that kids could do. And the Americans, by this time they were selling big time in America. Scholastic took them up, but they wouldn't take body tricks unless we made a change, and we refused to make a change.
What did they want taken out?
The Ouija board.
Why?
We had a Ouija board in one called Strange Things, and they didn't like the title body tricks either. So a British bishop complained about the Ouija board and somebody in America complained about the title Scholastic, about the title Strange Things. It was too spooky, I think, for children. Children's publishing was very conservative then. This is early 80s, and it was still dull, really, and we livened it up a bit for a while.
Now when I have to read, well, very happily read stories to my great-nephews and nieces,
yes.
They're all about bums and crime and violence, and yes. This is for three-year-olds.
Yes, 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 but they're issued with warnings and parents are advised not to read them and, you know.
Oh, for heaven's sake,
it's
yes.
a much more nervous period now than the 1970s were. You know, we just thought kids were, if we treated them sensibly, they were sensible and it was up to their parents to make sure they were, if they were sleeping outside looking at the night sky, they were warm enough. It wasn't our job.
Yeah, exactly. And then Kathy Lett turned up.
Yes, they turned up, Kathy and Gabriel Carey, with a guitar, of course, and came into our office and sang us a puberty blues song that they'd written to persuade us to take on their manuscript. And we, of course, fell big time for puberty blues, although it was shocking. There were terrible things in it about how to give your girlfriend an abortion. And we said, listen, this has got to be edited. And you can edit it in the office, but you have to show us and we will do it in one hit and just, you know, tell you whether you're getting away with it or not. And somebody in the office, I don't know, might have been died, just thought we'd ask Jermaine, who was in Cambridge at that stage, Jermaine Greer, to write us a cover line saying puberty blues was wonderful or whatever she wanted to say. So we sent it off to Jermaine, didn't hear a thing back. So we finally went ahead and published it without Jermaine. And years later, we got a letter from Jermaine recommending that we didn't publish. By then, we'd sold heaps.
What was Jermaine Greer's objections?
She thought it should have an anthropological expert framing it. It was a very academic response to it. It was very fascinating.
Oh, dear God.
That letter exists in the archive somewhere, but it was true.
And how many copies of Puberty Blues did you sell?
Oh, heaps, heaps. I don't remember, but it went on. It's still in print. Penguin have kept that in print too, as far as I know.
And, of course, you would have got a cut of the film, you would have the television series. Money must just have kept pouring in, Hillary.
No, we didn't get a cut of the film. That's not how it worked. No, we didn't. We just sold more copies because of the film. We did a film edition, you know, like people did in those days with a film cover.
But oh, yes.
We didn't get a cut of the film. Heavens, no.
Who was your agent?
I don't think we had an agent.
That was Di Gribble.
Di was
She was business, wasn't she? Weren't you words and she was business?
Oh, that was sort of a crude. We were everything. We did everything together. We certainly, there was nothing that I did that I didn't get Di's approval and vice versa. You know, we were a partnership. That was the crucial thing, really.
The firm earned some nicknames. Can you recall any of them off the top of your head?
No. They were terrible nicknames.
But weren't they just a measure of how loved you were in the industry?
Well, that's what we like to think, yes.
Yes. McPhee, Gribble, Fuck Me and Grapple, wasn't that?
That was a terrible one we didn't know existed.
Ah.
We heard about that later and that was kind of shocking. But
disappointed authors, I think.
Disappointed authors and furious men. There were men who were frightened to come to our office, we heard, on the grapevine. Barry Oakley was nervous about coming. I hope Barry's not listening. He's still going strong. But we were doing marvellous books. Tim Winton came to us because Alan and Unlam turned down a collection of short stories by Tim. They said, we don't do short stories.
Good move.
So Tim came to us
and,
yes, we grabbed him and had him from then on. And when we were later acquired by Penguin, we had Cloud Street. We had wonderful Tim books, which are still out there.
I'll get to the Cloud Street issue a little bit later. Tell me, how did Australian publishing or the British the British publishers who called themselves Australian Publishing, how did they cope with you? Were they welcoming? No, they weren't.
It was dreadful going to London. We had the bright idea that we'd go to America first, where the American agents wanted to see us because they'd never met an Australian publisher before. And they were interested in what we were doing, and they were interested in Australia. So we'd go to New York first. It was usually me that did that, and went around the agents and the publishers, who couldn't wait to see us. They were marvellous. They'd say things like, oh, I reckon this conversation's worth a page of my, what were those diaries called that you had to pay for by the page? I can't remember. Anyway, and then we'd go on to London, where no one wanted to see us because we were really in the way as an Australian publisher. They wanted to deal direct with Australian authors and not have us with Australian and US rights. So that was our clever thing, really, that we went round the world a different way. But it meant that in London we suffered. Nobody rang us back. No, very few people took us out. Carmen Carlile was a dear friend at Virago, and she was very supportive and bought books from us. She bought Monkey Grip and This Bared My Centre, a wonderful book by a woman who was in a nursing home who got the message to us that she wanted to, that she'd written a book, and we got her to show us. And we, it was a diary of being in a nursing home called This Bared My Centre, and that sold really well in Australia. No one had done such a book, and Virago sold it really well in the UK. So we were doing good things. We had very interesting books, but the British publishers punished us. They didn't want us.
Did you cut a path for other independent publishers at this time? I mean, were the people who saw what you were doing and making such a splash and follow?
Look, there were other feminist publishers then, and we didn't describe ourselves as feminist publishers, but the women's press was up and running in London, and they had, I think, a couple of people in Australia. So feminist publishing by the early 80s was around. But small publishers have a very hard time making a living out of it, and none of them lasted very long. Nor did we, sadly.
Well, why, with all of this acclaim and success and the extraordinary degree to which you were, you know, bringing new writers to the Australian readers, why did this not translate into prosperity for you?
Because we were trying to... Look, I'll go back a step. Brian Johns, the wonderful Brian Johns, came to Penguin. He wanted to be a publisher before he became a broadcaster. He came to Penguin in the early 83, I think, something like that, and became publishing director. And he hot-footed it to our office almost as soon as he arrived because he'd heard about us. And we just became great friends. And every Friday we'd meet and he'd talk his ideas, we'd talk our ideas. We were a kind of partnership without an agreement in a way. And Penguin was selling our books and they were doing well for them. But when Brian left to take up the SBS job, there was a huge party in Melbourne and Di and I were at it dancing the night away, but we knew in our bones that everything was going to change at Penguin because there was a new, much more conservative English managing director that had come out who didn't, who thought that what we were doing was... That our terms were too agreeable, I think, that Brian had organised a reasonable rate for us and that we should be being squeezed a bit. And they then proceeded to squeeze us. And we decided we'd buy ourselves out and go into partnership with Carmen or with someone else. I mean, we had big ideas. And the squeeze hit just as... Keating's recession we had to have hit in 87, 89, interest rates for borrowing went as high as 17%.
Yeah.
Someone even offered us 21% to do a list of pornography. And, you know, it was just nobody understood publishing and we were caught in this awful, awful net really. And we realised in the end we had nowhere to go but to Penguin. So,
but there is a rumour... These stories abound in the publishing world. There is a rumour that at the time you were facing, this financial squeeze, You had not yet published Cloud Street. And if you had published Cloud Street, might it all have been different?
Yes, it would have been different because Cloud Street was a huge success. But it wouldn't have been different enough. We've employed 12 people at this stage and we were in a lovely, shabby office in Fitzroy. And we were, I suppose, a bit big for our boots. We once had a staff meeting at a weekend trying to persuade the staff that our standards were too high.
What?
Because there was not editorial standards, but publishing, you know, production standards. People would work all night to get rid of things that they'd spotted or woken up thinking about. And our books were kind of perfect little paperbacks. They were far too perfect. And I remember Dyer trying to say, look, we could just bring out books that were 70%, not 90%. And everybody looked white with horror and went on doing what they did.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
But anyway, that was the end of things. So we were swallowed up.
And when you were swallowed up, the two of you, Dyer went one way, you went another.
It was terrible. That was the terrible thing. Because Penguin only wanted me because they thought if I was there, the authors would stay. And that was such a stupid thing because if they had both of us, a whole lot of other authors would have stayed. Dyer brought in people like Ignatius Jones, for goodness sake, and Red Simons and all kinds of funny, popular people. And I was bringing in literature and ideas, books, and, you know, they needed both of us. But they only wanted one of us. They only wanted me. And I had to go out to Penguin and save a few jobs. I saved four or five jobs by persuading Peter Field, who was running the place at the time, that I couldn't do everything. You know, they just thought they'd roll us into Penguin and that would be the end of us.
So there you were, nearly 15 years, and the great example of what independent publishing can do in this country. Now all the way down the track, what does independent publishing in this country look like to you?
Look, it's like it's gone full circle in a way. I mean, I must admit I don't spend a great deal of time gazing at it, but I do look at what's coming out. And the English are still dominating our market, but the Americans are getting bigger too, and the Americans own a lot of the English international companies now. So multinational publishing is more alive than it ever was. It's huge, absolutely huge. And AI is going to change all that again. I mean, there'll be need for fewer editors. Editors will go on being required, but an awful lot of those jobs can be done initially by AI and then fixed up by a good editor, perhaps. I don't know. I worry about it.
Well, yes. But, you know, the wonderful thing, Hilary, is that the problems of AI are really going to have to be dealt with by people much younger than us.
That's
much,
right.
Much younger than us, yes.
That's right, yes. Exactly.
Tell me, before you go, what is the most exciting book you've ever edited?
Oh, God. Oh, I think I would have, look, there were so many, but I think I would have to say Cloud Street. The Children's Bark is another, which I adore. It's the only book of real fiction that Helen wrote, I think. It's a wonderful book. That's still in print. I mean, a lot of these books are still in print. But Cloud Street, I reread Cloud Street every few years, wondering if it's going to stand up, wondering whether it's now too old-fashioned or something, but it's not. It's marvellous. It's a marvellous book.
Perhaps, Hilary, that is the greatest testament to McPhee Gribble of 50 years ago. Your books are still in print.
Yes, that pleases me mightily. Pleases me mightily. But I'd love to see the Practical Puffins back in print, but not as puffins.
Hilary, congratulations. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. Hilary McPhee, one of the founders of McPhee Gribble, legendary firm in the Australian publishing and reading world. Thanks for joining us on Late Night Live. Coming up, Shelter in the Sand. Some of them were built by families desperate for anywhere to live in the Depression, others by fishermen after the war and hippies in the 60s, beach shacks made with flotsam, jetsam and old tin. Councils want them gone, but they're now fiercely protected because, as Anna Clark writes, these shacks are now an iconic part of Australian coastal history. Anna is a professor at the Australian Centre for Public History at UTS, the University of Technology, Sydney. She's the author of a very serious and much admired book, Making Australian History, and she's nuts about fishing. She's written a history of that too, called The Catch. Now she's working on a history of the beach, which we're digging into for this talk about beach shacks. Anna, welcome.
Hi, David.
Anna, I have to ask, you write about beach shacks loved by shackies. Mm-hmm. Are you a shackie?
Oh, gosh. I had never thought of myself as a shacky, but the term emerged as I was researching for this piece of work about beach shacks and the people who love them. And it comes from sort of shack communities of shackies. And so technically, I suppose I am, in the sense that I'm very fortunate to access a shack that my parents bought a long time ago. Is actually on my grandparents' old farm on the south coast of New South Wales.
So how do you define a shack? Because I suspect the shack you're talking about probably has running water and flush toilets. That's not a shack, is it?
It doesn't have running water or flush toilets.
Aha.
My one, oh, I shouldn't say mine, our family shack has a solar panel which runs a little light and a fridge and has tank water, no hot water, we cook on a fire. It's actually a hippie shack built by hippies in the late 1960s, early 1970s. I'd say most people think about the beach shack as exactly as humble as you sort of, you know, described there. Maybe fibro, maybe bits of, you know, repurposed corrugated iron, old windows. Bit of driftwood, fishing boys washed up. Sort of hanging around like a
net
acting as a some sort of awning or passion fruit vine trellis.
I have a theory, mm-hmm. And because this is a very academic discussion, theories need to be closely investigated. I have a theory that lots of us think we've had holidays at beach shacks when we were children, but we really haven't, but we've just read about them.
Is it like the sort of memory of the moon landing, you know, which actually happened before I was born, but I feel like I remember it because it's so ubiquitously all around?
Yes, I think it could be that, though I, of course, watched the moon landing in a small television set up in the Rural Bank headquarters in town. I think it's that, and in very old people, I was there when the Queen landed in 1954. But let's divide up the shacks. Very interesting you've mentioned a third category, because it's not just fisher folk, depression folk, but it's also hippies.
Yeah.
Let's go to the fisher folk shack.
Yeah.
Why build a shack? Why not just come and go?
Yeah, well, I suppose in the, you know, when fishing shacks first started to be built in the late 19th century, it was a time when Australians became more interested in the natural world. And things like the Royal National Park is declared, bushwalking groups appear, bird watching groups appear, and fishing, and people had always fished in Australia, of course, even in First Nations communities into deep time. But in terms of, you know, colonial shacks, there was a growing sense or a growing interest in fishing for pleasure on the weekend. The weekend becomes a thing, you know. And so rather than just sort of pitching a tent in the sand dunes, which many people did, when they found the spot they wanted, they put up a little shack so they could stash their stuff.
And presumably to be on hand when the tide is right.
Absolutely. To be on hand when the tide is right, to come back to the same place, to be able to return for holidays, for weekends, for the right moons and tides. And also these places were on public land invariably. There are some exceptions, but a lot of them are where there's no development. So the access to these places is facilitated because they're often quite remote and they're on public land.
And kind of nobody else wants them. Once you've built your shack, it was yours, wasn't it? They were just like squatters, weren't they?
Yeah.
You claimed your spot and it was your spot.
Yes, and you kind of perched there. And, you know, sometimes these communities were actually farmers in Western Australia, for example, who in between farming seasons went to the beach to have a summer holiday or to have a little bit of an annual holiday. They came with stuff. And then on Crown Land, they would put up a little shack to return to every year.
And then if they brought their family, the shack had to get bigger.
That's right. So the sort of the shack that you're alluding to in what a shack looks like is cobbled together, literally, and maybe another room is added to. They're sort of like lean-tos. And the earliest ones would have been kerosene tins and driftwood, as you say. And over the years, as they get added to and as people have access to more things, that sort of very basic shack, if it hasn't washed away, becomes a little bit more permanent.
And they do survive.
Yes, absolutely.
How old are the oldest shacks?
Well, the ones that we know, I think, you know, probably from the 1920s, there might be earlier, so happy to be directed to any earlier ones by people. There are obviously remnants of Aboriginal occupation of beach sites all around the country, but timber doesn't last. So these beach shacks are actually quite recent, mostly in the 20th century. And there were some in the late 19th century, I believe, but they were very sort of basic and you know, literally washed away.
So we should acknowledge the fourth and original category of beach shack, which is the Indigenous beach shack.
That's right. And, you know, there are the first sort of colonial accounts of First Nations culture do mention these shacks right around the coast as colonists encountered First Nations society. You know, people have been living on the beach for thousands and thousands of years. And if you think of the sort of natural bounty of Australia and sea life, of course the beach was occupied. And people after then thought that was a good idea too.
But then comes the Depression. And in the Depression, people are desperate to find somewhere to live.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, it's the coast where they're able to find unwanted land. How on earth could beaches be the unwanted land of the Depression?
I know. It's one of the sort of really curious stories about this history, actually, is in the 1920s, beach shacks are sort of built by workers often, you know, quite humble working shacks of people wanting to get away for the weekend and make holiday and sort of have holidays. And in the 1930s, some of those workers, many of those workers lose their jobs. And where do they go? They go to these beach communities. And for those who didn't have a shack in these beach communities, they walk down to the community and build a shack there. And like, it's amazing when we think of the sort of the wealth that's required to have a coastal property today. In the 1930s, the coast was the worst sort of land because there wasn't this sort of sense of, the exclusiveness of the coast. The coast was the crappy farmland. So that a lot of it was actually quite accessible. And that's where these shack communities grew up.
Bondi was a working class suburb.
Yeah, there were shack communities in the Depression, in the Northern Beaches, on the sort of headlands there where people camped for years during the Great Depression.
Do any of these Depression villages survive around Australia?
Yeah, they do, particularly in the Royal National Park south of Sydney. There are some incredible shacks there that have their origins from the sort of 1920s onwards, but during the Great Depression, they became permanently occupied and they're still standing. And in fact, they now have heritage protection.
So the local councils have been told to back off.
Well, it's been a tricky sort of, they were built on different parcels of land. Like in the Royal National Park, they were built on actually on an existing farm, and it's only when they became resumed, or I should say, when that land became taken up by the Royal National Park, that this conflict about what should be there emerged. But a lot of the shack communities were actually built on Crown land.
Who owns these shacks now? Not Depression folk.
Well, the sort of, if you live in a shack, you don't feel like you're in the Depression because they're so kind of amazing. But the simplicity of that life does have echoes to that time, I think. It's hard not to be in those shacks and not to think about what it must have been like in those times. But, you know, you still, many of the shacks in the Royal National Park, for example, are walk-in. And they don't have lots of amenities, and they are very simple still, and that's part of their enduring charm.
Are you looking at the literature of the beach shack?
I'm trying to, and I'm also really interested in people's memories of the beach shack, as you said, you know, that people think that they have a connection with the beach shack, which might be through literature if it wasn't their own experience, but I think a lot of people do have connections where they might have visited a beach shack with friends, families as a child, and it can have quite a powerful imprint. I'm also really interested to think about, you know, when we go on holidays, beach shacks have a kind of a summer, a wonderful sort of basicness of living by the beach for an extended period of time and fishing and sort of being conscious of the tides and the wind and the changing weather. And I'd be interested to sort of compare that with how it felt for those in the Depression. I mean, I've come across lots of memories of children who sort of reminisced nostalgically about it being a very free and lovely time because they were with their parents and there was so much freedom and they were living by the beach. But I'm also interested about the extent to which there might have been shame and desperation of people who'd been evicted. You know, there's sort of incredible sort of funny accounts of a family being evicted in dark humour, I should say, being evicted in Glebe and saying, "Oh, don't worry, we'll just go to our weekender."
You know?
And they went down to La Perouse to their illegal fishing shack by the beach in La Perouse. In a settlement called Happy Valley. And so to what extent is that kind of dark humour masking actually a deep anxiety and it's that change in sort of the emotions attached to those places that I'm also interested in. And that's actually really hard to find.
I'm talking to the historian Anna Clark about her investigation of the Australian beach shack. Anna, it must have felt so different for people in shacks if they were there for the summer, a holiday, a break from their lives, or that's where they lived.
Mm. Yes, that's right. The sort of and still to this day, there are sort of permanently occupied beach shacks, although they're much sparser than those that are used for holidays. That sense of trying to make a life for yourself in those places. You know, the coast is not the easiest place to live. It's great for fishing, but if you have to live there permanently and, say, in the Depression, you're unemployed and need to barter food, you can get a sense of the sort of desperation and the difficulty of that.
It's interesting though, isn't it, that they lived in settlements of shacks because I suppose they were looking after each other to some extent.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that comes through when you look at, you know, a number of these shack communities, particularly in Western Australia, but also in New South Wales as well, they've got sort of Facebook groups and community associations. And one of the things that keeps coming up in the heritage reports where these sort of shack communities are trying to save themselves from being, you know, demolished or moved by local councils is that sense of communitarian spirit as a sort of an enduring theme that is one of the attractions and one of the things that should be preserved about the shack communities.
Let's go behind the glamour to talk about the hazards of life in a shack. I want to go down a list of hazards with you, mm-hmm. Anna. First hazard, sand.
Sand everywhere. If you don't like sand, I mean, probably a beach shack is not the place to be. It's a kind of an amazing thing because in a way it's beautifully protected from the beach. You know, you've got four walls and a roof, hopefully, but the wind still whistles through the shacks usually. You know, they're not built to particular standards and you feel kind of cosy and snug. But also they're quite precarious and the elements do manage or have a habit of getting inside, if you think of wind and sand. In places in Western Australia, the dunes march across the shack communities, and it's actually a battle to sort of keep the sand out.
They swallow them?
Yeah.
Okay, sand, mosquitoes.
Yeah. I think my backyard in the inner west of Sydney is worse than camping. But yes, absolutely, mosquitoes, ticks.
Ticks, of course. But what was the old way of dealing with mosquitoes before we had Mortine coils?
I guess lighting a fire.
Smoke.
Yeah, smoke them out. And if anyone sort of lit a fire by a shack with driftwood, there's plenty of smoke.
Winter.
Cold. No insulation. Damp. Yeah, I suppose it depends where you are, though, too, because there's something sort of delightful about feeling the seasons change in a very basic and humble place. You really feel like the inside is quite part of the out.
Privacy.
Again, this is something that we have all become quite used to, I suppose, in modern life. If you think of, a housing advert, how many bathrooms are in a modern house? Everyone has privacy all the time if they want. But perhaps our parents' generation or grandparents' generation, there would be one bathroom in the house and children would absolutely share bedrooms for a long time, maybe even with their grandparents. And the shack, I suppose, is a reminder of that living on top of each other. And when it's a holiday, like I think my kids actually really enjoy being in one room. I don't know. I don't know if they'll listen to this. They might ring up and complain. But certainly for a long time.
We do corrections on Late Night Live.
Yeah, you might get an angry email at some point. But certainly when they were young, they actually, I think, enjoyed being in a room with us. And there's something about, that the sort of family being together, extended and mixed. And, I don't mean necessarily a nuclear family either, but there's something about togetherness and kind of living on top of each other, which can also be nourishing.
You mentioned hippie shacks. Your experience is a hippie shack experience. Mm. What's the history of the shack that you go to?
The shack that I go to on the south coast of New South Wales was built by hippies. On my grandparents bought a farm there in the late 1960s, and some hippies asked if they could build a shack on their property. And my grandparents they said, yes, sure, why not? It shouldn't be a problem. And they built this incredible collection of, two little building, one-room buildings, one of them out of old hardwood from a timber yard and treated hardwood, and the other built from stones from the beach and driftwood. And if you think about, living there with three children, with just tank water, boiling nappies over the fire, I think it was pretty remote.
When you said hippies, I had an image of sort of dope-smoking kids playing the guitar, but this was a family.
I think it also included smoking and guitar playing, probably not with the children, but that's with the time. It was, a sort of an attempt to try something different and to get out of the city. I mean, one of the people who designed this shack, Mary Anderson, she had worked as an architecture student on the Sydney Opera House, and she was dropping out as a hippie and to live in the bush in this teeny tiny one-room shack.
How long did they live there for?
I think it was a couple of years, but it got very remote. It was a dirt drive all the way into the nearest town. It would have been, pretty difficult. And eventually they left and went to a commune in the mountains nearby.
Look, I'm wondering, in the time we have left, could you tell me what it is about fishing? I mean, my father was a fisherman. I mean, he fished from boats, he fished from the rocks, he fished. I never understood it.
I can see by your face.
Anna, what is it about fishing?
For me, it's about being in a place. I mean, there's a sort of an excitement of fishing, which is, if you like that excitement, but it's the same excitement you might get from...
Excitement?
Oh, the thrill of catching a fish, the jerk on the line. I mean, I'm not going to tell you how to feel.
No. I want to know how... you feel.
Yeah, sure. Well, I get the same kind of thrill from catching a fish as somebody who's been looking for a Gouldian finch for 4 years might feel, you know.
Or turning up the great document that finally explains.
Exactly, exactly. It is like that. It is like that. But there's an adrenaline rush of the physicality of fishing. And I think one of the pleasures of it, Robert Hughes has written beautifully about this. It's not actually about the end result, about the catching of the fish, which is can be hugely thrilling if it's a big fish or you've been fishing for a long time with nothing and you get a bite and it's all embodied. So you feel that tug and you have to reel it in and you have to deal with the live creature and you have to either put it back or you have to kill it. It can be quite visceral.
So there's a life and death decision there.
There's definitely a life and death decision. But so much about fishing, 99% of the time you spend fishing is not catching a fish. So why do we do it?
That's also the question. I would say 99.99%.
Perhaps. Depends how good a fisher you are, I suppose.
That's fair enough.
And in that other 99% or 99.99%, you're being in a place like a bushwalker or a birdwatcher. And it's for me, it's like a beautiful... it's a form of mindfulness, I suppose, where I can literally stand in a spot and a kingfisher might dart before my eyes. Or, last week I was fishing in a lake, an estuary, and an octopus was sort of feeling around my feet, just sort of gently, a tentacle coming across my sneakers. I was knee deep in water, and then it just jumped onto my legs, flashing madly. And I was like, "What are you doing? It's my leg." So you have these kind of extraordinary encounters with the natural world and, tides and wind and waves. It's a way to take you outside yourself, I suppose.
And then you bring the catch home. But as a woman fishing, you can't expect your husband to clean your catch in a way that traditionally in Australia men have brought their catch home and the women gut and scale the fish. Where are we in Australia on this important question?
That's an interesting one. I've always loved fishing since I was a little girl. And one of, my fondest memories is going fishing with my dad and my uncles and my granddad. But I was the only girl in my extended family who did fish. So it still is the sort of the overwhelmingly, it feels like a male pursuit, but actually a lot of women fish. Maybe 30% of women of fishers are women. So there are a lot of quiet, mindful women fishers out there who enjoy both the contemplation but also the action, I'd say.
Anna, thank you very much. I've been talking to the great historian, Anna Clark, about her absolutely public passion for A, fishing, and B, the shacks of Australia, still dotted, still surviving around the coast, and about to be part of the subject of her History of the Beach. Anna, thanks.
Thanks, David. It's lovely.
And that's the show. On our next, fresh discoveries from the archives of Leni Riefenstahl, Hitler's favourite filmmaker, who to the bitter end of her long life pleaded ignorance of Nazi atrocities. That's no longer so clear.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.